In this episode, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit hears oral argument in Sanchez v. Rubio. At the heart of the case are two siblings, Carlos and Claudia Sanchez, who were born in the United States and held U.S. passports as children. In 2014, when they applied to renew those passports as minors living in Mexico, the State Department denied the applications, citing concerns about the midwife who had registered their births. Years later, after both had turned 18 and moved to Texas, they filed suit under Section 1503A of the U.S. Code, a statute that allows a person to challenge a denial of U.S. nationality. The government moved to dismiss, arguing the claims were filed too late, more than 5 years after the denials. The core legal issue is whether the statute's 5-year time limit is subject to equitable tolling, and if so, whether the time during which the plaintiffs were minors living abroad should be tolled, given that the statute uniquely requires a plaintiff to reside in the United States to bring a claim. The district court dismissed on jurisdictional grounds no longer pressed by the government, but left open the key equitable tolling question in a footnote.
Sanchez versus Rubio.
Brandon Good now begins the argument for the plaintiffs, Carlos and Claudia Sanchez.
Is it Mr. Gould?
That's correct, Mr. Gould.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Brandon Gould from Covington & Burling, and I represent appellants Carlos and Claudia Sanchez. In 2014, when Carlos and Claudia applied to renew their U.S. passports, they were minors who lived with their parents in Mexico. They were still minors residing in Mexico when the State Department denied those applications. But once they turned 18, Carlos and Claudia moved to the United States, established residence, and filed an action under Section 1503A.
Section 1503A is the statutory provision that allows someone whose claim to U.S. nationality has been denied by the State Department to file a civil action in federal district court. The statute requires the person to reside in the United States and to file in the district where they live. It also imposes a 5-year deadline, running from the final administrative denial. The question in this case is whether that deadline can be extended through equitable tolling when extraordinary circumstances prevented a timely filing.
All within 5 years of becoming adults. The key question in this appeal is whether it is plausible that equitable tolling would apply to the time.
Equitable tolling is a judge-made doctrine that pauses or extends a statute of limitations when fairness demands it. Courts generally require two showings: that the plaintiff pursued their rights diligently, and that some extraordinary circumstance beyond their control prevented timely filing. The Supreme Court has held that most federal statutes of limitations are presumptively subject to equitable tolling, unless Congress clearly intended otherwise. The government here argues that Section 1503A is different, that it is a mandatory claims processing rule, not subject to tolling at all.
When Carlos and Claudia were minors living in Mexico, given that Section 1503A, unlike virtually any other statute, requires them to reside in the United States to bring their action. If the answer to that question is yes, their claims are timely, and if not, then they're not. But critically, that key question has never been answered. And that's because the district court dismissed the case principally on jurisdictional grounds that are no longer valid in this circuit. But absent that jurisdictional obstacle, the district court recognized that Carlos and Claudia's status as minors residing abroad was a key question that it needed to answer for the equitable tolling analysis. It left a footnote, footnote 6 in its decision, saying, quote, "The court does not reach whether equitable tolling would apply for the time period during which each plaintiff remained a minor. This court should remand to the district court to answer that question in the first instance." But if the government has its way, that key question will never be answered. And that's because the government is seeking something extraordinary here. Even though most statutes of limitation are presumptively subject to equitable tolling, and even though Section 1503A is just ordinary, on its face, ordinary run-of-the-mill statute of limitations, the government now argues for the first time on appeal that Section 1503A is a mandatory claims processing rule.
A mandatory claims processing rule is a procedural requirement that a court must enforce if a party properly raises it, but which, unlike a jurisdictional rule, does not deprive the court of power to hear the case, and unlike a jurisdictional rule, is subject to waiver and forfeiture. Whether it may be equitably tolled depends on the specific rule's text and is a question the Supreme Court has expressly left open. The distinction matters. Jurisdictional bars are absolute, while ordinary statutes of limitations can be tolled. The government now concedes that Section 1503A is not jurisdictional, but argues it is still mandatory and thus immune from tolling. The plaintiffs counter that it is an ordinary statute of limitations subject to the usual equitable rules.
Not subject to tolling. That argument flies in the face of the court's reasoning in Villegas-Sarabia and also a long line of Supreme Court precedents on other statutes of limitations.
The 28J case Cortez.
Yes.
Does that eliminate your alternate argument? Would you agree now we're just focused on the time?
The third argument, as in 1503A doesn't apply at all here?
Passport denial essentially is a denaturalization.
We are not pressing that argument today at oral argument. There are some distinctions between our case and Cortez in terms of the grounds of denial, and we think that those distinctions should be considered on remand by the district court. We also note that the Cortez case, the plaintiff in Cortez has filed a motion for reconsideration and reconsideration en banc, and the statutory interpretation arguments that Cortez and then also our case presents are very colorable and in our view, a plain reading of what the statute says. I think as this court,
if there were no error as to the motion to amend, what did the pleadings themselves say if we reach equitable tolling?
The pleadings themselves,
almost just entirely the minority status.
Okay, it's not solely the minority status. It is a combination, and all of these facts are pleaded in the complaint. The fact that when the passports were denied, they were minors, they were residing in Mexico, foreign country. And that this particular statute, 1503A, unlike most other statutes, requires a plaintiff seeking relief under it to reside in the United States and file in a court with jurisdiction over their place of residence. So that constellation of facts, well-pleaded facts, all in the amended complaint, raises a number of key factual issues about that are relevant to equitable tolling. And if I may indulge, I'll just go into that, some of those facts. So they're minors when they get the passports denied. So they reside in Mexico. They can't bring their claim in Mexico where they live. They have to uproot their lives in Mexico, again, as minors, have to travel to the border. Again, it's not at all clear whether they would be accompanied by their parents, so they may have to abandon their parents. Their parents are citizens of Mexico, not United States citizens. The record does not say whether or not the parents would be able to also come to the United States. And even when they got to the border, they would be subject to all the criteria of inadmissibility at the border. Whether or not they could meet those inadmissibility criteria is an open question. Again, the State Department has denied them passports, so there are serious questions about how they would be able to get in to establish residence and make a 1503A claim.
Where were the denial letters sent?
The denial letters were sent to their parents in Mexico.
Oh, so the Department of State, okay, so they yes. Received them and they're different, and they received them on different dates.
They received them on different dates. And
Different reasons?
Slightly different reasons, but for the purpose of our main arguments here on the statutory interpretation question and on the equitable tolling question, not significant difference. May make a difference on that third argument about whether 1503A applies, because one is more similar to the Cortez set of facts and the reasons for denials, and the other is a little bit different. But again, we're not pressing that argument at this stage.
And the district court, which we're reviewing, made a straight, absolute jurisdictional rule.
District court said
the government is not defending that anymore because of Villegas Sarabia.
The court is referring to a recent Fifth Circuit decision, often shortened to Villegas Sarabia, which held that Section 1503A's time bar is not jurisdictional. That ruling invalidated the district court's original basis for dismissal in this case. The government has since shifted to a new argument that even if the statute is not jurisdictional, it is still a mandatory rule that does not permit equitable tolling. Plaintiffs argue that Villegas Sarabia's reasoning that mandatory language alone does not override the tolling presumption also forecloses the government's new position.
Exactly,
therefore,
because
they pivoted and they're making the mandatory claims argument that would still not permit equitable tolling. Am I right?
That is correct. And in doing, in making that no equitable tolling mandatory claims process argument, they are recycling many of the same arguments that they made in Villegas Sarabia and that the court rejected there. So, for example, they argue that this is a mandatory claims processing rule because the statute is, quote, couched in mandatory language. They focus on the word only in the statute. But Villegas Sarabia says that is not sufficient to overcome the presumption that Villegas Sarabia ruled on jurisdiction. Not sufficient to overcome the presumption as jurisdiction. It's also not sufficient to overcome the presumption that equitable tolling applies. If you look at the cases that Villegas Sarabia relies on, I'd point you to Beckler versus IRS. In that case, they conducted an analysis of both jurisdictional and also equitable availability of equitable tolling. And the court said presumption not rebutted on either of those cases. And the reason the presumption isn't rebutted is because of the grounds of the presumption itself. The presumption is that when Congress is legislating, passing a statute of limitations, it is operating on the background legal principles that equitable exceptions and remedies, like equitable tolling, are available. And it takes very strong evidence, a clear statement, or some significant evidence to the contrary, to dispel that congressional intent. And there's just no such evidence here. That's what the court found in Villegas Sarabia. That's also what the court finds in Beckler versus IRS, in which Villegas Sarabia relies. So another argument that the government makes here that was rejected in Villegas Sarabia is that this time bar is close in proximity to other parts of the statute that have jurisdictional or mandatory requirements. But the Villegas Sarabia court dealt with that same issue, and it said that proximity doesn't matter. Quote, it doesn't matter that the jurisdictional grant and the filing deadline appear in the same provision or even the same sentence. And again, in reaching that conclusion, it also relied on Beckler versus IRS, where the Supreme Court came to the exact same conclusion when facing the question of equitable tolling in addition to the question of jurisdiction. So again, same question. Very similar questions should be very similar outcomes. A third argument that the government makes for why this is mandatory is that the statutory purpose is to prevent fraudulent entry for questionable claims of citizenship. And I will admit, Villegas Sarabia does not deal with that third argument that the government makes. But another Fifth Circuit case does. And that's Cambranes versus Blinken. And in Cambranes, the court said that the statutory purpose of preventing fraudulent entry applies only to subsections B and C of the statute, not subsection A, which is where the time bar resides. So I would submit that the government's arguments for why this is a mandatory claims processing rule are all either foreclosed by existing Fifth Circuit precedent, or at least strongly not supported by existing precedent. They're also not supported by a long line of Supreme Court precedent that says the situations in which
the presumption in favor of equitable tolling can be rebutted. And I will note that the government doesn't really seriously engage with the main Supreme Court case on this issue, which is Brockamp versus...
Brockamp is a Supreme Court case that set out several considerations for determining when Congress has rebutted the presumption that equitable tolling applies to a statute of limitations. The factors ask whether the statute is highly detailed, technical, or unusually emphatic, whether the time limit is repeated multiple times, whether Congress provided express statutory exceptions to the deadline, whether the deadline also caps the substantive amount of recovery, so that tolling would extend substantive and not just procedural limits, and whether the statute's subject matter involves mass administration that makes case-by-case tolling impractical. Plaintiffs argue that Section 1503A fails every part of the test and is therefore subject to tolling.
United States. And there's a good reason for that. Because this statute, Section 1503A, comes nowhere close to meeting Brockamp's four-factor test. Doesn't meet any of the elements. Brockamp's first factor is whether or not the statute is, quote, highly detailed, technical, or unusually emphatic. And on the face of this statute, there's just no language to that effect. To the contrary, this is just an ordinary, run-of-the-mill statute of limitations. And the Supreme Court said in Holland versus Florida, when you're facing an ordinary, I'm quoting here, ordinary, run-of-the-mill statute of limitations, those are statute of limitations that are subject to equitable tolling. Presumption not rebutted. Second criterion for rebutting the presumption that equitable tolling is available is whether or not the statute reiterates the time bar multiple times. In Brockamp, there was an IRS statute that restated the time bar six different times, including on some substantive provisions of rent relief. In this case, statute of limitations is only stated once, the bare minimum, different from Brockamp. Brockamp's third criteria is whether or not there are express statutory exceptions to the time bar. And that's important because express exceptions signal an intent from Congress to dispel implied equitable exceptions. In Brockamp, there were six express exceptions to that tax statute of limitations. Here, zero. Zero for three for the government, and I'll just close on Brockamp's fourth criteria, which is this a domain in which equitable tolling is traditionally considered to apply? In Brockamp, it wasn't. That was a tax statute applying the tax code. It's not an equitable area of law, traditionally. But here, this involves questions of citizenship, which are amongst the most important rights and privileges that exist. And as the Supreme Court recognized in Holland versus Florida when considering equities on the writ of habeas corpus, that's exactly the domain where equitable principles are most likely to apply. So again, government cannot rebut the presumption in favor of equitable tolling. So then the question becomes, what should the court do? Well, how should the court deal with the claim for equitable tolling for the period of time when Carlos and Claudia were minors residing abroad, given that this statute would have required them to move to the United States, establish residence before they could ever file a claim? That's the key question, and it has never been decided. The district court's footnote says, I am not deciding this question very clearly. There is not any decision from the district court on that key question that will determine whether or not the actions were timely. So there's not even an affirmable decision from the district court as to equitable tolling. In this case, you need to remand to the district court to decide that again. And there are three main reasons why you need to remand. One is equitable toll, the principles of equitable tolling itself. It's a fact-intensive inquiry that requires consideration of all the facts and circumstances of an individual case, and it is not subject to bright-line rules.
Footnote 6 is about minority status. It doesn't specify the domicile.
It doesn't specify the domicile point, but the point
which is a good point. And, but am I correct? They presently are in Texas.
They presently are in Texas. No one contends that they didn't satisfy that part of 50.
The issue is the time.
The issue is wholly the time bar. And I will also note, I know my time.
And it was denied originally under Secretary of State Blinken, correct? The case began in
2015. No, I think it was a little bit. I think a little bit before, and it may have been under two different secretaries of state because it was two different decisions.
And NOS has multiple hearings. The successor judge, whose ruling we're reviewing, had no hearings, correct?
Say that again.
Judge Hinojosa had three hearings on this issue.
I believe that's correct. Yes, and a case was transferred to a different judge who issued the denial. I'm running over a little into my rebuttal time, but I want to just say a few couple reasons why it's important to remand in this case. First, I already went over principles of equitable tolling. Fact-intensive, not subject to bright-line rules. Second, the procedural posture of this case. This was decided on the motion to dismiss standard, where all facts need to be accepted as true that are in the complaint, and all inferences from those facts need to be drawn in the plaintiff's favor. That's especially important.
What's your third issue? Because you can talk about this on rebuttal. What's your third reason?
My third reason is how this court has handled similar claims where there is an unresolved key question related to equitable tolling on appeal. Here, the key question is, do you toll the statute for the time period when there are minors residing abroad? And in Bernstein...
Now you're into your rebuttal time. You saved time for...
All right. I will come back to that in rebuttal.
Thank you.
David Barley now begins the argument for the federal government.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Barley on behalf of the federal government. I first want to thank the court for the opportunity to speak today. It's my first time in this court and my first time in Louisiana, and it's a pleasure to be here. So in light of this court's two intervening decisions in Sarabia and Cortez, this appeal really comes down to really just two issues. First, is 1503A's time bar uniquely optional amongst the rest of 1503A's jurisdictional or mandatory requirements? The government posits that answer is no. Second, whether optional or not, did the district court abuse its discretion when it determined it would not apply equitable tolling under what was presented to the district court, even if it believed that it could?
Let's step back, because you've been with this case for a while, correct?
No, Your Honor, I took over the appeal.
You're just handling the appeal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Just to be clear, the government is not defending the district court's absolute jurisdictional law.
We don't believe that argument is viable after Villegas-Sarabia, so that's not something.
The district court was wrong legally.
Yes, the district court was incorrect. It's no longer upholdable after Sarabia, and the government isn't looking to relitigate Sarabia.
So, in other words, you've read the record here. Judge Hinojosa was just incredulous that the government would say children can be stripped of U.S. nationality, and then the government doesn't have to offer any proof, because they can stand behind an absolute jurisdictional bar that their parents didn't challenge the proof within 5 years. So the government is no longer defending the district court's ruling that would happen. The successor court, correct?
No, Your Honor, the government
it's
is not.
Failed.
The government is not.
Now you've pivoted and you say it's a mandatory claims processing rule. And that's equally inhospitable to any opportunity for a child to say my parents shouldn't have neglected to respond to that letter. Is that the outcome you're pressing?
So, Your Honor, the government is arguing that this is a mandatory claims processing rule.
Therefore, not subject to equitable toll.
No, Your Honor.
That's not your position?
The government with any mandatory claims processing rule as described by Nutrilis Pharmaceutical by the Supreme Court, they are not subject to equitable toll.
So that's my point. So you're taking the same position that you took originally, that children whose parents forget or don't, for whatever reason, respond to an allegation that the midwife may not actually have properly signed the birth certificate, never get to put the governments to a swoop. They just lose their nationality because time has passed. That's the logic of your ruling.
So, Your Honor, first off, the parents were questioned in connection with this case, and they were participating.
No, I'm just asking, are you saying, these children will never have the opportunity, because it's a mandatory claims processing, so they can't argue equitable tolling allows them to test the government's rule. Is that your position?
So, Your Honor, there are more than one way to get to a 1503 claim, right? The court in Sarabi was considering an N-600, which is a certificate of citizenship. This is a case considering a passport. So there are at least those two ways to get review of that claim. The third way is removal proceedings, and that's not an issue here because, to my knowledge—
I'm sorry, what was your first way? I couldn't hear you. You said there's removal, section removal proceedings. What was the first way?
So there's the form N-600 denial, which is a request for a certificate of citizenship from USCIS. I believe that was what was at issue in Sarabia. And then the third avenue for most 1503A claims is passport refusals. So there is a way.
So you're saying if you prevail, they don't have a chance here. They have two other ways, so they wouldn't be deportable themselves, or they could go visit their parents in Mexico. You're saying they have both children, Carlos and Claudia, have other ways to make to test the government's statement that they're not U.S. citizens.
There are other ways to get to a review of the citizenship claim, yes. But in terms of cross-border travel. So in terms of cross-border travel, that's a different sort of circumstance because you need entry documents. If they were to go to Mexico and then were denied entry, they could go through the 1503B and C procedures, which this court upheld as adequate in Hinojosa. Or if they're denied a certificate of citizenship by the Secretary of State, in theory, they could raise an APA claim.
In theory.
So there are ways to get there.
Okay. So in this case, they just want their opportunity. And your position is, because it's a mandatory claims processing, how is that reconcilable with Cortez? In Cortez, Judge Smith with Judge Oldham, I forget who the third judge is, in the argument section, 2-3A, they say equitable tolling. And they say, not justified, it would be futile. How is that not our court in a published decision saying these are subject to equitable tolling? They just may not be earned.
So the government reads Cortez as assuming without deciding that equitable tolling is available. It didn't say whether or not 1503 is a mandatory or permissive claims processing rule. It just simply said that equitable tolling wasn't warranted on the facts of this case. And I think that's the government's alternative argument here as well. To the extent that the court does not want to announce a general rule about whether it's mandatory or permissive, it doesn't have to. What the district court found here was that based on what was presented in the complaint, based on the allegations in the complaint, they did not make arguments or allege sufficient facts to establish that equitable tolling would be warranted.
That's a single sentence where the court says no due diligence.
Your Honor,
the footnote. But as to Claudia, the footnote renders the conclusion impossible, correct? Claudia's entire 5 years, she was a minor.
So, Your Honor, there's two responses to that. One, the district court did not find that there's no possible way they could ever establish equitable tolling, even if it's available. What it said was, based on what they presented and what the allegations were in the complaint, that it was not warranted.
Right.
Those are two different.
It says, I don't see due diligence. Footnote, I'm not considering minority status, whether that would be, excuse them. But for Claudia, at least, that's the entire period.
So, Your Honor,
what if the court were to look at that issue and decide, because she's a minor, that justifies equitable tolling?
So the district court here dismissed without prejudice. They could certainly file a more developed complaint and try to relitigate that issue. But what they
Isn't the cleaner solution? We say the district court erred legally. The government acknowledges that it erred legally jurisdictional. It had a single drive-by sentence with a footnote that qualifies indeterminate. Why wouldn't we just send it back for that reason?
Because this court can look at the record. It can look at the amended complaint. It can look at the opportunities they had before they filed the amended complaint. It can look at the Rule 60 motion. In none of it did they request an evidentiary hearing on equitable tolling. In none of it did they request...
They being the parents.
They being plaintiff's counsel in the court below.
Right, but the point is the parents get this.
So the
and the case you cite is Alvarez, the forfeiture case.
So Alvarez stands for the proposition that equitable that minority status standing alone is not a basis for equitable tolling across the board.
Just to be clear, you're saying when they didn't request an evidentiary hearing, you're talking about the children, not the parents, right?
I'm talking about the district court proceedings. I'm talking about the district court proceedings. So they had a complaint.
The children did not request in the district court an evidentiary hearing. Is that what you're saying?
Your Honor, the children are not pro se here. They were counseled. So,
well, their lawyer didn't on their behalf, as opposed to the parents. I'm just, I want to make sure we're talking about the same proceedings.
So, Your Honor, in this scenario, what I'm discussing is what the district court record shows here. It shows a complaint that was originally filed with no allegations or no substantial argument concerning equitable tolling. There was an amended complaint with no developed allegations or substantial argument towards equitable tolling. And even plaintiffs acknowledge in their brief and in a footnote to their opposition to motion dismissed that the complaint probably doesn't have adequate facts to support equitable tolling here.
But I don't understand this argument, because you're saying after 5 years it's too late unless you can come up with some equitable reason. And the equitable reason is they were children at the time.
So, Your Honor, I think there is certainly a...
Your response to that is, well, parents can waive the children's right to notice, citing the forfeiture case. What other case did you give us?
No, Your Honor, the Alvarez case simply stands for the proposition that minority status standing alone is not an adequate basis for equitable tolling.
Case stands for that proposition? I thought Alvarez was cited by you that parents can be responsible. No?
They are presumed to be also adequate surrogates in terms of diligently pursuing rights and in terms of diligently pursuing their rights. So what we have here is parents who were participating in the passport process. They were interviewed by agents. They did not pursue the 1503 B and C avenues to present a 1503 claim. They did not respond to the letters requesting additional evidence of their births. So I think it's very hard to...
On your own in the department, both from the Supreme Court and the Department of State, citizenship is a status that's personal to a citizen. One person may not expatriate on behalf of another. Next sentence. Parents may not take the oath of renunciation or otherwise seek to relinquish the U.S. citizenship of minor children.
Right. I don't think there's any argument here that the parents have relinquished their claims. But
I thought the argument is they're not entitled to equitable tolling because they didn't respond within 5 years.
The argument is that they're not entitled to equitable tolling because there's nothing in the complaint that shows that the parents were inadequate surrogates for pursuing their claims.
But that assumes the parents can surrender their right to citizenship.
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does. I think it only presumes that parents are presumed to be adequate surrogates and can litigate claims standing in third party standing for the children.
And they didn't.
Right, and they didn't.
No due diligence, no extraordinary circumstance.
There's nothing.
The entire circumstance in the original complaint is they were minors, and the district court said, I haven't considered that.
So the district court said it was not reaching that issue. They alleged that they were minors in their complaint, but they did not allege that either that prevented their due diligence or that was an extraordinary circumstance for which equitable tolling should be applied. All the government is saying here is that the complaint needs to contain more when the facts accepted as true show that the claim is untimely. They also need to allege facts showing that equitable tolling would be justified in the circumstance. And I think if the court looks at the complaint, which is what the government is primarily focused on here, the allegations just aren't there. And the district court can't be found to be abusing its discretion in finding that it would not apply equitable tolling, even if it believed that it could, if the arguments and the allegations are not developed in the complaint. It cannot flesh out plaintiffs' arguments for them, construct the sole argument that wasn't made, and then decide, okay, well, I would apply equitable tolling based on the argument that the court has constructed. I think what plaintiffs are asking is for the district court to do far too much. They're asking the district court to imply into the complaint allegations and arguments that just aren't there.
Let's say we don't agree either with your original position that the district court bought, which is no longer valid legally, or the second position that is mandatory, don't even get a chance to argue equity. So we do remand and we let equity, then there'd be some inquiry into what actually happened to disqualify them, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's a few different.
So therefore, just on this record, what is the basis that the government says Claudia is no longer a U.S. citizen? What was the articulated letter basis?
So the letter basis for denying the passport was that there wasn't sufficient evidence to determine that they were U.S. citizens. So it's an issue of evidence, of putting evidence before the Department of State.
So and U.S. citizen has to prove to the Department of Justice that they are a citizen?
So the
to be a citizen?
Any passport applicant has to demonstrate to the U.S. Department of State that they are a U.S. citizen in order to obtain a passport.
Right, but we know from Cortez the effect of a passport denial is equivalent to non-nationality.
Yes, Your Honor, for the purposes of a 1503A claim.
They didn't convince the U.S. government that they are burst nationals. Therefore, the denial means they are no longer nationals.
No, Your Honor, the denial means that they haven't put forward enough evidence to establish that to the Department of State that they are nationals for the purposes of obtaining a passport.
And yet the evidence they have was the Department of State said you were in the first passport round.
So, yes, Your Honor, the Department of State did approve the initial passport application. My understanding is that subsequent information came to light that the midwives involved in registering their births were doing that fraudulently for other people.
Were they prosecuted?
I'm not sure of that, Your Honor. That's not on the record.
There's an allegation that a midwife, does that mean the government's position is any child that midwife in that clinic delivered is presumptively not a U.S. national?
So, Your Honor, I'm not familiar with other cases involving the same midwives and how those were treated. Those are just not on the record.
So the government sends me a letter and says, we think the person that delivered you, the doctor, did it fraudulently. If you don't answer within 5 years, you're not a citizen. Is that basically the logic here?
So let's try to disambiguate what 1503A says and what the letter says. So the letter gave them 60 days to submit evidence from the date of the receipt of the letter, establishing that they were providing evidence that they were U.S. citizens. A Department of State agent also interviewed them in 2016 and asked for that information. So what 1503A says is that, okay, once there's a first final administrative denial, you have 5 years from that date to pursue a claim in a United States District Court in which you've claimed residence.
Just so we get the terms right, when you say you didn't, they didn't, you agree at this point they're minors.
The
person who would do it, according to the government, is the parent.
The applicant, yes, Your Honor.
And the parents didn't do it. They didn't respond.
Yes, Your Honor. I under the facts of this case, that is what it tends to show.
And Carlos is denied later. It was also because of the midwife?
So my understanding is that it was the same midwife, but again, the record isn't entirely clear on that.
Does the record reflect there are any birth certificates other than the one in the United States?
So there's a birth certificate from the United States. There's also baptismal certificates from Mexico as well as a birth certificate. As well as birth certificates from Mexico.
Okay, and do the birth certificates from Mexico that are in this record reflect that indeed they were born in the United States?
I'd have to go back and look at that, Your Honor, but I believe that the Department of State determines that...
I'm looking at record page 582, the translation of the Mexican one. It says Lugar de Nacimiento. This is the Mexican birth certificate. Texas, Estados Unidos. So it seems like the two birth certificates actually corroborate each other.
Right, Your Honor, but they could be based on what is a fraudulent registration in the United States.
They could, okay. I haven't heard this one before.
So, Your Honor, I have to go back.
No, counsel. This is trying to say to people that they're no longer U.S. nationals. So now you're suggesting the registrar, Anna Carrillo, who signed the U.S. one, she may be the fraudster.
So, Your Honor, I would have to go back and look at what the names of the midwives are. I would have to go back and look at that.
Midwife is different. You could have a midwife that is fraudulently signing U.S. birth certificates. We could have that, but you're saying the government never prosecuted anyone for that. So then the government's suggesting, oh, we've got a Mexican birth certificate. We do have one in the record. They all corroborate these children were born in the U.S. So now you're saying there's a registration problem or there's a baptismal problem.
So, Your Honor, I would like to get back to the issue here, which is what the complaint alleged. These are all great arguments, and they could be great arguments.
Yeah, but the government's saying they can't be made. The government's saying you can't test our proof. We said there's an allegation about a midwife. You're no longer a U.S. national. And you're saying these are great arguments, but the government's position, your position legally, is they don't ever get the chance to make the arguments.
So my position legally, the government's position legally is one that 1503 is a mandatory claims processing rule. If the court is not inclined to accept that, what our fallback argument is that the complaint simply does not contain enough allegations to warrant the application of equitable tolling here. That's the same issue as it was in Cortez, where the court went back and looked at the record and said, okay, the complaint here doesn't contain enough to show that equitable tolling would be available. or would be warranted in the circumstances. Sorry, Your Honor?
Were they minors in Cortez? Were they relying on their parents to assert their right?
No, Your Honor.
And footnote 6 says that could be a big problem. People who are children probably don't know how to litigate across international boundaries and say to the government, what in the world do you think is the reason I'm not a U.S. citizen? So you rely on parents. But the district court said, I haven't really thought about that. I haven't reached that issue.
The district court is relying on the pleadings and the record before it. So it's relying on the amended complaint. It's looking at the opposition to the motion to dismiss, and it's looking at the arguments made there. I think what we're getting into here is the merits of the 1503A claim, when we really should be looking at whether equitable tolling is warranted based on the allegations of the complaint. And
thought you were saying that even if we decide that equitable tolling applies, you're saying we shouldn't send it back because their pleadings don't say enough to even get them a hearing even if you lose on everything else. Is that what you're saying?
So what I'm saying, there's a couple different dispositions for this, Your Honor, even if the court agrees with the government. One is it's simply to affirm that there was no abuse of discretion based on the record before it. It could also do a simple remand and ask the district court to reconsider whether equitable tolling would apply. Plaintiffs could then file a second amended complaint, including more allegations and arguments. That's also available. All we're asking the court to do is just look at what the district court looked at. The record.
You're just saying, based on the pleadings that were in front of the district court and whatever else was in the record, it's insufficient to establish equitable tolling.
What was presented to the district court, Your Honor, the government's position is insufficient to establish equitable tolling. Just on what was presented. We're not saying that any of the facts themselves, if fleshed out, any of the arguments, if fleshed out, are never categorically going to be warranted for equitable tolling. What we're saying is that the district court's record just simply doesn't contain those allegations, and it doesn't contain those arguments to sufficient detail to where the district court can be found to abuse its discretion. Okay. Again, what we're saying, this is a pleading issue.
One of them, I think, is respectful about the gravity of the situation. You're saying it is available to us to remand so it can be fleshed out.
Right.
The government's accepting that?
The court could remand without deciding whether it's mandatory or permissive, and it could remand for further development just based on Villegas-Sarabia. The court could do that without addressing equitable tolling at all. But again, the government's position is that the district court's order could be affirmed because the record is so deficient in that sense. And all parties agree that the record is deficient to support arguments for equitable tolling. Plaintiffs blame the district court for it. Plaintiffs also acknowledge that the complaint doesn't contain enough facts to support equitable tolling.
I have one quick question. Just, I'm not sure it will make any difference. How much record do we have about the midwife? Is there anything other than the letter questioning it?
So, Your Honor, I don't believe that there's a ton in the record about the merits of the 1503A claim. What the record is developed around is the equitable tolling and the arguments that were presented in support of equitable tolling in the court below. Unless there's any further questions from the panel, I thank the court for its time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I will just note and invite the court to take a close look at the transcript when it comes out. The government made a major concession right back there. They did not say that, as pleaded, the facts could not support an equitable tolling case if they were fleshed out. They said, it's possible that if the facts that were pleaded in the district court were in the amended complaint were fleshed out, they could potentially support a claim for equitable tolling with further factual development and drawing inferences in favor of the plaintiffs, which is what the court does in a motion to dismiss standing. And the district court itself recognized that there is a potentially viable claim for equitable tolling from the facts that were pleaded in the case. On the original pleadings. Those pleadings are minor status at the time of denial, residence abroad, and a statute that requires you to come to the United States, establish residence, and bring your action in the place where you live in the United States. All those combination of those three things are sufficient to plead a viable claim for equitable tolling. And to the extent that there's any question whether or not those facts need to be fleshed out a little bit more to consider the individual facts and circumstances of Carlos and Claudia, the proper course is to remand for that development. And I'll note, and the government doesn't disagree with that. The government doesn't disagree
that these facts could be fleshed out further on remand. So that's a major concession. I think that is dispositive, and you don't need to go any further than that. I will say, on remand, actually before we get to remand, the plaintiffs here actually requested leave to amend their complaints in the event that the district court thought that they were not sufficient to state a claim for equitable tolling. They requested that in opposing the government's motion to dismiss. Now, of course, district court didn't grant that request because it found that there was a kind of insuperable jurisdictional barrier to proceeding in this case. But now that jurisdictional barrier is gone.
Was that request to motion to amend clear, or was it in a footnote, the motion to dismiss?
I believe it was in a footnote, but I'll note that the dismissal was out without prejudice, and I think it certainly could be the case that on remand would renew a motion to amend the complaint, and that may be a path forward if there are any questions as to whether the original complaint was sufficient. The district court, with its footnote, seemed to recognize that there's something here as to the equitable tolling claim. But if there's any doubt, then we can amend our complaint on remand. We didn't do it this time because the proper course here was we've got a clear jurisdictional barrier to proceeding under this. So the right course is file a Rule 59 motion, where we again argued the equitable tolling in addition to the jurisdictional thing. And then appeal the jurisdictional holding, which Lega Sarabia invalidated. So we proceeded with reasonable diligence, which is all that is required for an equitable tolling claim.
Do any other circuits adopt the R. Old Gonzalez Flores absolute bar?
I mean the bar that was stated as dicta?
1003 is jurisdictional and stuff.
No, I'm not aware of any. I think most of these cases arise in Fifth Circuit.
Or if any that say it's a mandatory claims busting rule, therefore
not that I'm aware of. No, I don't believe so. A couple more things before I end. The government mentioned that there are alternative avenues to litigating a claim of citizenship. It made a couple of misstatements there. It referenced the N-600. That is only available to putative citizens who were born out of the United States. That's obviously not the position of Carlos and Claudia here. They say they were born in the United States, and they were born in the United States. The government also referenced 1503 B and C, but the district court, in the decision that's on appeal, said that 1503 B and C is not an alternate way of bringing a claim under 1503 A. It is just a pathway to get to 1503 A. So that's not an alternate way of deciding this question of citizenship. And it's a very important question of citizenship, because as Your Honor has pointed out, the government's position stands for the proposition that a parent could forever waive a viable claim of citizenship on behalf of their citizens. That is a bright line rule that is especially inappropriate.
Can you explain my record apprehension? Because in the joint pretrial order, there is a statement by predecessor counsel signed by permission that there are Mexican birth certificates that state Mexico place of birth. But in the record, the Mexican ones I read look like they confirm it was Texas.
I think as the government, and I see I'm out of time, but I'll certainly answer your question. The government points to a number of kind of purported inconsistencies in some of the record below. And I'll admit that there are, at times, some inconsistencies.
My question is just a yes or no. Are you aware of any Mexican birth certificate that doesn't say born in Texas?
I am not aware of that. But with full disclosure, I did not handle the district court proceedings below. Your Honor is right to point to the fact that in the record, the Mexican birth certificate mentions the Texas location of birth, as does the U.S. birth certificate, and as does the baptismal records that counsel for the government mentioned. And with that, I should probably stop talking.
Thank you, counsel. The court will adjourn until 2 o'clock this afternoon.
The Fifth Circuit took the case under advisement. No decision was announced at the close of argument. A published opinion will likely issue in the coming months. The panel must decide whether Section 1503A permits equitable tolling, and if so, whether to remand for the district court to apply that doctrine to the facts of this case. The outcome will affect not only Carlos and Claudia Sanchez, but anyone, particularly minors living abroad, whose U.S. nationality claim is denied and who seeks judicial review years later.